Well, thank you for the introduction, and thank you for inviting me to Toronto, my first visit. So, today I'll give a sort of introduction of this area of research, and then I'll be talking quite a lot about the type of tectonics that planets have, including plate tectonics or episodic plate tectonics and rigid lids. And then I'll go through some detailed models of particular planets, specifically Mars and Venus, and also discuss some other planets. So what we're studying here is convection of the Earth's solid mantle. So this is like, well, convection in a normal fluid. Now, although the mantle is solid, it behaves as a fluid over long time scales. So deforming by very slow viscous creep. And because it's cold near the top, the rocks there become very stiff, and so they form these plates. So that's where you get plate tectonics, and then there are different boundaries to the tectonic plates. There's the ridge, or spreading center, where the oceanic plates spread apart, and then the trench, where the oceanic plates go back inside the Earth. So really, the oceanic plates and the mantle are a sort of integrated system. We should try and treat them together. And this is powered by radioactive heating of uranium, potassium, and thorium that's sort of inside the rocks, and also the fact that the planet started off very hot after it accreted and is gradually cooling down with time. And so to study this, it's really important to look at a variety of different things. I'm doing fluid dynamical calculations, but there are various observations and other fields that are important for this. And for Earth, one of the most important things is seismology. So by studying seismic waves, seismologists can come up with these three-dimensional maps of the interior of the mantle. And here we see just red and blue are variations in the seismic wave velocity inside the Earth. So that gives us information about the three-dimensional structure. Mineral physicists study either in the laboratory, this is a big press, or in the computer, this is sort of a simulation of a lattice, you know, the physical properties of the minerals that make up the rocks and how they vary with temperature and pressure. Geochemists measure the trace element concentrations in magmas that erupt at different places around the Earth, and find that, you know, the interior of the Earth is not homogeneous, but instead there are various, you know, end members or reservoirs that they can identify based on looking at the trace elements. And then magnetism is important, and actually what's happening in the mantle very much controls what's happening in the core. I won't go into that. Also, there are various cycles that take place between the surface environment and the interior. You know, volcanoes outgas various things, including water, you know, nitrogen, hydrogen, and so on, carbon dioxide, into the atmosphere. And at the same time, these oceanic plates that go down carry some of these things down with them. So there's a long-term cycle between the atmosphere and ocean and the interior of the planet. And another important thing is not only to look at the Earth, but to, you know, consider other planets. This is Mars, although it's not very clear. And try and come up with a sort of theory by which we can explain all of them. Now, this is a little bit complicated because, you know, you get these nice large-scale cartoons like this. But when you go to rocks in nature and look at them, you find small-scale structures. Like here's a person, and you see this fold that's, you know, sort of about the size of a human. And when you zoom in, you find that the rock is layered with layers that are even smaller than a human. And here we see faults. It's another person. So again, you see layers, you see faults that are much smaller than the person. So how can we possibly represent all this in sort of a global model? It's a problem. And that was sort of mechanical, but also when we look at composition. So seismologists come up with maps of the interior, as I've mentioned, and we can interpret those in terms of composition, which is plotted on the right, and temperature, which is plotted on the left. And according to seismologists, you know, they're approximately equally important in the deep Earth for explaining variations in seismic wave velocity. And then, as I mentioned, geochemists look at trace element variations, and they find large variations in composition over fairly small length scales. And when you go to a rock in the field, well, particularly outcrops of mantle rocks, you also see layering that's on the sort of tens of centimeters length scale. So the thinking is that this type of layering also occurs inside the mantle. So it's a very multi-scale problem to understand all of this. So these are the challenges in trying to understand how the Earth and planets work. One is, let's do the second one first. It's a multi-scale problem. I mean, we have length scales from millimeters to thousands of kilometers. It's also multi-scale in time, from, say, earthquakes that occur on sort of second time scale to billions of years, which is, you know, your sort of continental drift time scale. So what related to this is the rheology. That describes how the materials deform. And this is complicated because it depends very much on temperature. So the viscosity of a rock depends very much on temperature. It's often nonlinear. So in other words, the stress versus strain rate relationship is not linear. It's nonlinear. And you get not only viscous creep, but also brittle failure and plasticity, which is sort of related. And on short time scales, you also get elasticity. So if you want to write a sort of an equation for the deformation of rock, you really need to include all of these terms in order to cover all possibilities. So in reality, of course, we can't include all of those terms in all of our models. But I'll be talking about very large-scale models. This gives a spectrum of other activities that are going on in my research group at in Zurich. And a lot of modeling is done at these much smaller scales. So this is sort of at a crustal scale and modeling a shear zone formation. This is also the plate, this, you know, magma migration through the plate. Then there are regional models sort of underneath oceanic plates or this subduction zone, another subduction zone model. So we're really performing models at all different scales, trying to look at the effect of these complex rheologies. But I'll be talking about the largest scale. And for this, we're doing a lot of models in spherical geometry using a code that I've developed over many years. It uses a grid like this with staggered locations for velocity and pressure to solve the sort of momentum, continuity, and energy equation. And then it uses particles or tracers to track the compositional variations, sort of the so-called particle-in-cell method. And, you know, it runs on parallel computers. The mesh in spherical geometry is interesting. It's the so-called yin-yang mesh, which is really like the way that you put a tennis ball or a baseball together from two patches like this that you then sort of stitch together at the boundary. And this is a way of covering a sphere while giving reasonably constant resolution or grid spacing. Because if you use a standard longitude-latitude mesh, you see that the lines converge at the poles, and this can cause some numerical difficulties. Anyway, that's enough. Well, just to give a comparison, okay, so this was during my PhD, 1993. So for this, we were running this on what was once the largest supercomputer in the world. But now you can do the same calculation on a laptop. So at least we can make some progress. So more about plate tectonics. We're so used to plate tectonics on Earth, but Earth is actually pretty unusual. It's the only planet we know about that has plate tectonics, in fact. The other major terrestrial planets, Mars and Venus, in our solar system, have what's known as a stagnant lid. So that means that the lid is basically not moving, or it's deforming very slowly, but it's certainly not divided up into a number of distinct plates that are moving relative to each other. Now, there has been some proposals that one or both of them has had plate tectonics in the past. Although for Mars, it's not widely believed, but perhaps it had plate tectonics early on, although it's not a popular idea. For Venus, it's a much more popular idea that it's had plate tectonics in the past. In particular, perhaps it had a transition from plate tectonics to a rigid or stagnant lid, and perhaps it has episodic overturn. Now, the reason for thinking that about Venus is because the surface age, which is obtained by counting the number of craters per unit area, is reasonably uniform at around 600 million years, which seems quite old, but it's a lot younger than, say, the surface of Mars or the Moon. And so this is interpreted as something happened, 600 million years ago to sort of resurface the planet. And it could have been that it had an episode of plate tectonics that sort of resurfaced the planet and caused a fresh surface, which we now see today 600 million years later. Some researchers have also proposed that features like this, so this is observed on the surface of Venus, could be a subduction zone, one of these places where on Earth the oceanic plate goes down. Anyway, so there are possible mechanisms, episodic plate tectonics or succession of plate tectonics. That's one type of idea. And another type of idea is that it's just resurfaced randomly by volcanic eruption, say. And, just because of the average frequency of resurfacing, you get a surface age of about 600 million years. So the episodic idea is not, uniform, widely, well, it's not completely accepted. There are other ideas as well. It's also widely thought that maybe Earth did not have plate tectonics throughout its whole history, but it may have had a different type of tectonics early on. And there are some reasons for thinking this. The oceanic crust was thicker in the past, making it more difficult to subduct, or maybe the basic scaling. Maybe I won't go into the details here, but just to say that there's a lot of uncertainty, and present-day Earth may be unusual. And the problem here is, of course, that we don't understand plate tectonics at a fundamental level for the reasons that I've already described. Rock deformation is complex. It's dependent on things like grain size and composition, including the presence of water, which could be very important. There's a range of length scales, a range of time scales. So, people are still working on this and have been working on this for some time, and it'll probably take a while to really understand it, which is okay because we have to do something until we retire. So, anyway, just start. People like me who model the large scale like to consider simple things to begin with. And the simplest case is just that the viscosity depends on temperature. And then we can ask, how much does the viscosity vary? So inside, at the surface of the Earth, the temperature is about 300 Kelvin. Now, if we go to 100 or 200 kilometers depth, the temperature is thought to be about 1600 Kelvin. So people in the laboratory measure. Well, this is a typical law for the variation of viscosity with temperature. And people can measure this E in the laboratory by deforming rocks. And if you use the E calculated in the laboratory with this temperature change, you get a variation of viscosity of about 48 orders of magnitude from the interior to the surface. So this is why you get this stagnant lid. So you get convection sort of below the stagnant lid, and then this is so viscous that it doesn't move. Now, of course, in reality, what happens is that when the viscosity is so high, other deformation mechanisms can take over instead, like brittle failure. And so, when you do laboratory experiments on rocks, if you compress them, at low pressure, they tend to develop lots of cracks. Right, so it's not viscous deformation. You get actual brittle failure. This is a plot of sort of the stress, the maximum stress that you can put on a sample of rock versus the confining pressure. As you see, at low pressure, they're fairly weak. As you increase the pressure, you require more stress to deform the rock. And so what we can do for our numerical experiments is just to sort of parameterize this in terms of a yield stress. So we can say that below some stress, the rock deforms viscously, but when it reaches that stress, it sort of breaks, and it deforms plastically. So we can put in a plastic yield stress, which has some profile depending on depth. So this is the stress, the maximum stress versus depth. Usually it's linear to begin with, then it reaches some maximum, and then below that it deforms viscously. So, okay, so if we put that in our convection models, so these are now numerical convection models, which you run for a long time period until it reaches equilibrium. And we have strongly temperature-dependent viscosity plus this plastic yielding that describes the finite strength of rocks. And what happens is that when this yield stress is very high, you get the stagnant lid mode of convection. Okay, so this is viscosity, and it's high viscosity, and then you get convection below the lithosphere. When the yield stress is let's say intermediate, then you actually get something that looks like plate tectonics. This looks like an oceanic spreading center. Well, let's point at this one. It gets thicker, so the plate is moving this way. It gets thicker, and then the plate turns by 90 degrees and goes into the interior. So this is rather similar to plate tectonics. And the top one, when the yield stress is very low, it's less plate-like. Instead, the lithosphere, or the plates, are more deformable, obviously because you've set them to have a low strength, and you get more distributed deformation. And more recently, my student was doing this in 3D spherical geometry instead of Cartesian geometry, and you get the same type of transitions. Stagnant lid, plate tectonics, and then more distributed deformation at low yield stress. And I'll show some movies of this. So this is a stagnant lid mode of convection. It's like a single plate covering the whole planet. It doesn't hardly deforms. This is convection. So red is hot, blue is cold. So there are small convection cells below this stagnant lid. Now this is in a plate-like mode of convection. So on the left, we see the viscosity, which is like the effective strength of the rock. So green and red is high viscosity, so that's a plate, and purple and blue is low viscosity, so that's a plate boundary where you get a lot of deformation. So let's play that again now that I've explained what it is. So these are plate boundaries, these purple things, that are moving around. Some of them are spreading centers. They're the ones that are red. They have the higher temperature. Some of them are these subduction zones where the plate's going down. Those ones are blue. But to some simple approximation, it's somewhat Earth-like plate tectonics. This is just with different parameters. So this is a spreading center because it's red here. This is a subduction zone. You can see the arrows here showing the movement here. So this is a completely, self-consistent system. We're not imposing any plates here. They're just arising out of the combination of temperature dependence plus yielding to allow plate boundaries to form. Now, it's nice to look at movers. What this student, Hein van Heck, did is try to develop scaling relationships so that we can predict what mode, a planet is in. As a function of the governing parameters. So one of the parameters here, like one of the most fundamental parameters you get in convection, is the Rayleigh number. Right? The higher the Rayleigh number, the more vigorous is the convection. And it turns out that the critical yield stress at which you transition from this plate-like behavior to the stagnant lid depends on the Rayleigh number. So here at low yield stress, this is mobile lid, so this is plate-like. This is the stagnant lid. And it turns out that as you go to higher Rayleigh number, the sort of transition stress decreases. So it becomes easier to have plate tectonics at higher Rayleigh number. I got that the wrong way around. As you go to higher Rayleigh number, it's more likely to be stagnant. That's right. Another thing that's important is the amount of internal heating. Now, I said that the mantle is partly heated by radiogenic or radioactive decay, and it turns out that the amount of radioactive decay also affects this critical yield stress. So this is the internal heating rate. It's non-dimensionalized. I won't go into exactly how that's done. And this is the yield stress. So on here are plate-like experiments. Each one of these dots is one of these 3D spherical numerical experiments. Right? So this is a lot of computational effort to come up with a diagram like this. But anyway, at high heating rate, it becomes more difficult to have plate tectonics, actually. So let's imagine, you know, that we have a fixed yield stress. So at low heating rate, you would be in the plate-like mode, and at high heating rate, you'd be in the stagnant lid mode. That looks like this. And this is important because during the planet's history, you know, these radiogenic elements decay. So the internal heating rate decreases. And so a simple interpretation of this diagram is that as the planet cools, you know, it's more likely to go from a stagnant state to a plate-like state. And what we've done is we've found some analytic relationship, which I haven't, I'm not giving you what it is, but it's this, you know, it plots as this blue line. So we found, or that my student has found, some analytic scaling laws that can basically describe the what's observed in the experiment. So now we can apply these to predict the evolution of actual planets. So to summarize this, plate tectonics is favored at higher mantle viscosity, which means lower Rayleigh number, and lower internal heating. Now, as a planet cools with time, both of these become more true. So the mantle cools, so its viscosity becomes higher, and the internal heating rate decreases. So this implies that as a planet like Earth cools, we would expect a transition from maybe stagnant lid behavior to maybe sort of episodic plate tectonics to plate tectonics. But of course, this is a very simplified system here. I mean, the only physical properties that vary are viscosity. Well, that's the only physical property that varies. So then you might ask, what are the effects of other things? And so one thing we're looking at is the effect of continents. Now, when you look at plates on Earth, there are two types of plate region. There are the oceanic plate regions and the continental plate regions, and they're quite different because the oceans are fairly young and they, you know, no more than 200 million years old, although that may not sound very young to you. But well, the continents can be up to billions of years old. Right? They're buoyant, and so what this student is doing is running models that have self-consistent plate tectonics and these continental units that do not subduct. And you can see some examples of the behavior. So here are the continents. Here are the continents plus the plate boundaries. So one point is that you quite often get subduction around the edge of a continent. So they act as preferred locations for nucleating these subduction zones. You also get a lot of cyclicity. So sometimes the continents will join together as a supercontinent. Sometimes they will split up and go their separate way. So we start off with six. And on the actual Earth, you know, geologists and paleomagneticians look at the actual what might actually have happened to continents. And it is thought that there is a supercontinent cycle where approximately every 600 million years, they join together into one big supercontinent, then they break apart, maybe drift around, and then join together again sometime later. So Now, by using this type of model, we're trying to understand this behavior, and also how the presence of continents affects the scalings that I was talking about earlier. And here's a model which starts off with a single large continent. You see here the behavior is much less time-dependent. But the continent does have, this is the core which sort of gets in the way. You have subduction around the edge of the continent. You have, I think this is a spreading center here. It's still moving a little bit. But this is generally much more relaxing than the previous case. Actually, I don't know why it's moving so slowly. I think my computer might be having difficulty. Another thing that continents do is they create a sort of asymmetry in the structure which can generate long wavelength structure in the mantle. And they also influence the heat flux, which is another thing that we want to understand. So I'm showing you these movers, but this really work in progress. Okay. Now, so this type of model, you know, is very promising, but when you look at them closely, the problem is that this subduction, that's where the oceanic plate comes into the mantle, is not really Earth-like. Instead, it's symmetric. So the plate comes in from both sides and then goes down symmetrically, and that's not what happens in Earth. In Earth, it's one-sided, so one plate goes down and the other one just stays where it is. So what is the problem there? And one thought is that in these large-scale mantle convection codes, it's usually assumed that the upper surface is flat. It's called a free-slip boundary condition because the topography on the surface of the Earth is a few kilometers. So compared to the size of the mantle, which is 3,000 kilometers deep, I mean, it's not very much. So it's normal just to ignore that. So this may actually create unnatural geometries. This is the an example of the actual surface of the Earth. And as you see, it's not flat. Although there's some vertical exaggeration here, so it's not as unflat as it looks. But the point is that when you have one of these zones where the plate goes down, there is a dip here. It's known as the trench. And you can actually see that these trenches are the lowest places anywhere on Earth. And so perhaps this might be important, because if we don't allow this in the convection model, the plate can't bend properly. And I won't talk about that. But when we put this into these self-consistent convection models, this is what we got with free slip again. When you put in something like a free surface instead, it looks quite different. And we do get quite often, or usually, single-sided subduction, where one side is going down and the other one is more or less staying put. So just changing the top boundary condition makes a first-order difference to the behavior in these models. And I can show some movers of this. So red means it's high viscosity. That's the plate, the lithosphere. And as you see, it comes down, subducts, although eventually it stops. Anyway, that's another problem. Oh, it's going to start again. Here we go. And then this is with this friction coefficient is describes the, it's the friction coefficient on faults, which goes into your plasticity description. We don't have actual faults in here. But now, being a bit stronger, the subduction tends to work a bit better. But then, eventually it stops and you get a stagnant lid. If the strength of the faults is too much, then it immediately becomes stagnant lid. So that looks promising, but it looks more promising in a spherical shell. I think most things look better in a 3D spherical shell. And here we have an example of, it's a bit dark actually, Anyway, you can see single-sided subduction taking place over here and over here and over here in this 3D spherical model. And on the left is the temperature field, where red is hot and green, or yellow is cold. So anyway, it's interesting that there's just changing this top boundary condition, something which only makes a difference of, you know, like a tenth of a percent when compared to the depth of the model, makes a first order difference to the behavior. So the free surface certainly leads to something that looks like single-sided subduction. So, but even these models are still much simpler than the actual Earth. I mean, the actual Earth, as I said earlier, has chemical variations. You get partial melting that then causes eruption that produces crust. You have phase transitions, which, you know, I studied a lot in the past, and so has Professor Peltier. The compressibility, you get very high pressures in the deep mantle, which changes the physical properties of the rock. So I'm not going to go into them now, but we are doing more realistic Earth models that include many of these additional complexities. Now, I won't talk about Earth models that include these complexities, but I'll talk about models of Mars and Venus that include some of these extra complexities. And for Mars, I'll talk about this study, which was published in Icarus 1.5 years ago. Mars is a stagnant lid planet, certainly. But its first order feature, when you look at the surface, is the crustal dichotomy. That is that the northern hemisphere is different from the southern hemisphere. The northern hemisphere is relatively low and smooth, whereas the southern hemisphere is high and has lots of craters, and also some of these, some volcanoes, and so on. Now, it's not a perfect hemispherical boundary, but it sort of goes up and down like this. Now, so there are two types of hypothesis for why you get this difference. One is we can call extrinsic, which basically means it's due to very large impacts. And then, even then, there are two versions of the impact hypothesis. One is that very large impacts came in and removed some of the crust from the northern hemisphere, creating basins. It could be several large impacts, or it could be one. Another one is that very large impacts came into the southern hemisphere, caused a lot of melting, which created thicker crust. So depending on your preference, you can make thick crust or thin crust with impacts. The other type of description is that it's intrinsic. It's something in the inside of the planet. And here what we really mean is degree one mantle convection. That's just another sort of map view of the dichotomy, showing that it's not a perfect dichotomy, but it sort of goes like that. Anyway, so I don't want to wait until the picture comes up. This is what I mean by degree one convection. So long wavelength that there's an upwelling on one side and a downwelling on the other side, right? Now, people in the past have looked at what physical properties are necessary to get degree one convection. And the bottom line is that, the most promising thing is to have the right viscosity profile. If you have, I think I've got a picture of this, yes. So this is viscosity versus depth. It's very high here where you have the stagnant lid. But if below the stagnant lid it sort of increases, and particularly maybe it increases here where you have a phase transition, then this leads to very long wavelength convection, which can give you your degree one. So people have found degree one convection in the past, and the question we asked is, does it generate the right crustal distribution? So in this model, we track where melting takes place, and then we assume that when you get melting, that the magma erupts above where it's produced and makes crust. So with this, we can run a convection model and, you know, generate crust and compare it to observations. Now, here are some details that maybe I won't go into, but we have, we have internal heating. We have compositional variations so that we can make crust with a rock type known as basalt. And this is what happens when you run the model. So on the left is the temperature. So this is hot, showing where hot material is. So you see the core because the core is hot. And then you see this upwelling ridge. So this is a sort of ridge-like plume. We call it one ridge convection. And what you saw is that it didn't start off like this immediately, but to begin with, you got lots of plumes, and then they sort of merged together to make this one ridge. But it's certainly an example of degree one convection. And on the right is the synthetic crustal thickness in kilometers, if you can read these numbers. Anyway, so you see that fairly rapid, this is the first billion years of Mars, right? So fairly quickly, you generate crust everywhere. So you get some melting everywhere. But in the southern hemisphere, you generate a thicker crust because you have this upwelling ridge. So now, using this mechanism, we can generate a crustal dichotomy. And this goes on forever unless I stop it. Now, of course, it depends on the exact physical parameters that you assume. So we've, varied the parameters. And depending on the exact parameters, you get some differences. This is a map view of the crustal thickness. I won't go into great detail on this. Maybe I'll just... I'll say one thing quickly because it comes up for Venus later, is that this melting acts as something like a thermostat. So where if you start off with the mantle being hot, then it just melts more and cools down. And so what we have here is temperature versus time with three different initial temperatures. After 1 billion years, they've all converged to the same temperature. But anyway, let's compare model to reality. And, if you use the same color scheme and you sort of defocus your eyes a little bit, then you can almost, see that the model is reproducing the actual observation. Now, we can be more quantitative than looking at pictures. We can actually look at a histogram of crustal thickness. So this is in kilometers, and this is the crustal thickness in kilometers. This is the probability type of thing. And this, of course, we don't know what the crustal thickness is on Mars, but people infer it from gravity and topography data, right, which we do know very well. So this is, you see that the crustal thickness is bimodal, according to this, with a separation of about 26 kilometers between the two peaks. And yes, some of our models don't fit. So here we have a sort of five-modal crustal thickness distribution, which is not quite right. But some of the models do fit. So here we have a bimodal distribution with about the right separation between the two peaks. Now, the overall thickness is more than this observation-based model, but anyway, we're working on that. Okay, so that's just a pretty picture to finish this section. So now moving on to Venus. Venus, of course, is different. This is a map of the surface topography, so it's not a dichotomy, but instead you get highland regions and you get lowland regions in between. So here's a highland, and then you get these sort of plains that are relatively low. But it's not like Earth, where you get a sort of step between the high parts, which are the continents, and the low parts, which are the oceans. It's a continuous topographic distribution. So there are no continents and oceans. It's just a continually varying sort of surface. And one of the interesting things about this is that when you... Whoops. Okay, stop. Okay, here is the topography, and this is something called the geoid, which is a surface of gravitational equipotential. Okay, so at the gravitational equipotential surface looks very much like the topography. And that's, maybe you say that's not surprising, but on Earth, it doesn't look like that, you know, there's very little correlation between the gravitational equipotential and the topography. So obviously Venus is operating differently from Earth. Anyway, in the early 90s, there was a spacecraft orbiting Venus, and everybody was interested in Venus and running models of it. But since then, you know, there's been much less interest. But still, there were many questions that were not answered at the time. One is, how does Venus lose its heat? If the mantle is producing about as much heat as Earth's mantle, how does it escape without plate tectonics? For example, is it through magmatism? Is it through episodic bursts of plate tectonics? Related to this is, how thick is the lithosphere? That means the sort of plate. Because if it's going to lose all of its heat through just conduction, it would have to be relatively thin. But observations imply that it's somewhat thicker. So, you know, there are various paradoxes here. And then there's that uniform surface age that I mentioned before. How do we explain that? So, models, they're very similar, actually, to the Mars models. They assume include compressibility, you know, temperature-dependent plus plastic rheology, compositional variations with melting, and the core and the mantle are cooling down. That's rather super. Okay, we won't go into all the details. I can discuss them if you're interested. But here's a case which remains in the stagnant lid mode for the whole history. So these are running for 4.5 billion years. On the right, we see composition, where red equals crust. So early on, you get this burst of crustal production. On the left is temperature. And then you see we have some plumes. They're in red. The crust is cold. And what's happening is that you know, the phase changes are having some effect, because you see something happening around a quarter of the depth. But the bottom of the crust is getting entrained in the convection, right? And so we're getting some red stuff, some crust, you know, inside the mantle. So it's not as if the crust is just created and then it stays there. It's being continually entrained, and at the same time, the mantle is melting in a lot of the places to produce more crust. So there's really this big turnover of the crust, entrainment at the bottom and melting, creating new crust at the top. And in fact, you'll see that the crust has got thinner over the history of this model because of entrainment has won over the creation of new crust. And you see the time here, we're at 3.8 billion years. So in this type of model, the dominant process is resurfacing due to melting and production of new crust, followed by delamination of the crust at the bottom. That's what happened that's what we predict if Venus is a stagnant lid throughout its whole history. Now, there are probably too many graphs here, but I'll just point to one of them, and that is the heat flow versus time. And in this sort of green fuzzy curve is the magmatic heat flux, right? That's the heat carried by melting and deposition of melt on the surface. And that's basically equal to the total heat flux. I mean, so almost all of the heat flux is being carried magmatically. Now, if we look at a histogram of the crustal thickness, sorry, it's not crustal thickness here, it's topography, okay? So the topography on Venus varies by a few kilometers. This is the actual Venus. This is the topography predicted by various of our models. Okay, so depending on basically what the viscosity of Venus's interior is, you can either produce much too much range of crustal variation, sorry, I keep saying, topographic variation, or about the right amount of surface topography variation. So this is one way we can constrain our models. We want, you know, to generate about the right histogram of topography. So this is our favorite model, you know, the model and the actual Venus. So with a stagnant lid Venus, we can generate the right range of topography. I didn't talk about the geoid, but we get that right too. But the problem with this model is that there's ongoing magmatism even to the surface. I mean, there's a lot of magma produced in this model. So the surface would not look 600 million years old. It would look very young, perhaps a few tens of millions of years. So that leads us to turn to cases where you have episodic plate tectonics. So again, we've formed a crust here, but now this is a burst of plate tectonics. So there you saw the lithosphere in many places around the planet undergoing subduction and ending up at the bottom of the mantle. And then nothing much happens for, you know, a few hundreds of millions of years, and then you get another burst of resurfacing, another burst of subduction. And then nothing happens for a long time. One thing you notice is that a lot of the former crust ends up at the bottom of the mantle in this model. So then nothing much happens for a while. So all the action here comes in bursts with relatively sluggish convection in between. So then nothing much happens, and then another burst. So we're at 2.5 billion years now, another 2 billion years to go. So then another burst of plate tectonics. I should say, yeah, these Venus models that I'm showing are two-dimensional, but we're also running three-dimensional models. It just takes longer to do a systematic exploration of parameter space. And you see at the bottom, actually, there's some small-scale convection in this layer has built up at the bottom. There's a layer of subducted crust. And most of the mantle is actually fairly depleted. And you get this thin layer of crust at the top. So now we reach the present day. Okay, so that's what it looks like. Now, when we look at graphs of what's happening, this is just velocity versus time. So you get these big bursts where the velocity becomes many orders of magnitude higher than the sort of average velocity between bursts. And the same when we look at resurfacing rate. So this is the eruption rate in kilometers per billion years. And you see it has this very spiky time history. So this really is the episodic resurfacing model that has been talked about, but not really. Well, it's been a conceptual model before, but I think these are the first models that actually reproduce it numerically, showing that it's, you know, a viable model. And yes, I'll show a 3D case, which for some reason evolves much more rapidly. Well, we get a higher time step between successive frames. But the overall structure ends up being the same. So another burst, nothing, and then another burst. And then nothing. It starts again. All right. So we check various observations. We look at crustal thickness histogram. Yes, and we can get about the right crustal thickness. We look at the gravitational signature, and we can get about the right geoid. So we actually prefer these models because you end up with a surface that can be, you know, half a billion or even a billion years old, if it's been that long since the last burst. And at the same time, you can also get about the right surface topography and the right geoid. So this is our preferred explanation. I won't talk about Mercury, but I just thought I'd throw up that picture because the instruction said we're supposed to show our most visual material. So, well, let's just, for future perspectives, so we've looked at all the planets in our own, all the terrestrial planets in our own solar system, but you know, one of the breakthroughs in the last 15 years has been that astronomers have found hundreds of planets around other stars. Most of them are not Earth-like. Most of them are like Jupiter. But they have already found a few so-called super-Earths, which is, you know, a planet with sort of terrestrial composition that's larger than Earth, between 1 and 10 times the mass of Earth. Here's one. I mean, it looks very featureless, but that's just because we don't know what it looks like, only the size. And so first-order question is, you know, do we expect them to have plate tectonics? Because that affects so much. including perhaps, you know, the ability to have life on the surface. So we have extended our previous study that I showed earlier to predict whether you would expect plate tectonics on super Earths. I don't have time to show it, but you know, we basically predict that super Earths are either equally likely or perhaps even more likely to have plate tectonics than the Earth, other things being equal, such as, you know, the heating per unit volume, the surface temperature, the surface conditions, and so on. So probably whether or not it has plate tectonics is more related to other things, such as whether you have liquid water on the surface or how close it is to its star and this type of thing. But in any case, we're running more realistic models now. As a sort of future perspective, I mean, it is expected that astronomers will find many more super Earths, perhaps not only Earth-like in being made of silicate, but also perhaps being made with a lot of iron or carbon or, you know, pure water planets. So there are all these different possibilities, and you know, it's useful to try and understand what we expect these things to be like. And so I think that there's plenty of opportunity in the future for, you know, planetary physicists to do useful things. Okay, so that's enough, I think.